what's going on with this guy.
Yeah,
that's perfect.
Perfect.
That's perfect.
Is that for the recording?
We'll start in a couple of minutes, just to
arrive. So you can just ignore that.
I'm guessing it's fairly settled.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So I'll just introduce you briefly.
Thank you for having me. So yeah, when a few years ago I began to develop a side interest in the philosophy of the search for extraterrestrial life, I think I explained this to some of my colleagues. I think some of them maybe wondered, understandably, if I'd lost the plot. It's not exactly standard fare in philosophy, certainly not in philosophy of science. But I think that's actually kind of curious, because if you look back at the history of our subject, just about anyone who's anyone has had something to say about this subject, in particular about what life, if any, there is out there. So, as far as I can see, the earliest recorded figure in our tradition who weighed in on the subject was Anaxagoras, he of everything and everything fame. And Anaxagoras confidently predicted that there would be large amounts of life on the heavenly bodies beyond the earth. Now you might think, so this is in the 5th century BC, you might think, well, what did Anaxagoras know about the constituents of the heavens? He probably held all kinds of crazy views. But in fact, he's also credited with being the first person to discover or postulate with reason that the moon, rather than being a god, was a ball of rock that reflected the light of the sun. So, I mean, this is a seriously smart guy. I imagine trying to work that out with the resources available to you in the 5th century BC. He's got his eyes fixed on the heavens, he's part of our tradition, and he's speculating about the prevalence of extraterrestrial life in some form or other. Now, we could go through just about every major figure in the history of philosophy up until fairly recent times and pull out something similar. So Kant, for example, in the First Critique, says that he would bet everything he has on there being life on planets beyond Earth. And so, in giving a talk on this, although it might not be part of the contemporary philosophy scene, it's actually very much a part of the history of philosophy in our tradition. Someone who fits nicely in that tradition is Emanuel Swedenborg. So it's fitting that we're here today. Not one I know a huge amount about, so I won't try and fill in the details. But the book on the slide on the right-hand side there, Life on Other Planets, is authored by Swedenborg. Right, so what we're going to talk about today is the contemporary scene in the search for extraterrestrial life. So I think that in the scientific community that's concerned with the search for extraterrestrial life and the exploration of space, so astronomers, astrobiologists, that's a big community, by the way. I think within that community, there is pretty widespread confidence, and a fairly high level of confidence at that, that there is a non-negligible amount of life out there beyond Earth in the galaxy. And I have various different sources of evidence for this. I'll give you the evidence shortly, I'll put the claim I have in mind up on the slide. I'm going to call this optimism. So when I talk about optimism, what I'm referring to is the confidence of that community, which is non-negligible, it's pretty high, I think, that life exists in our galaxy beyond Earth on a non-negligible number of sites. So one reason for saying that this is the view that is fairly widely held in the community is from survey data. So my colleague at Durham, Peter Vickers, has surveyed the relevant communities and has found this to be the case, there and thereabouts. Another source is quotation and anecdote, and I'll give you some of that, of which there is plenty, shortly. And a third source is behavioural. So there's an awful lot of money being spent right now within the relevant communities on the search for extraterrestrial life. Billions and billions of dollars on, for example, the use of the James Webb Space Telescope to examine the atmospheres of distant exoplanets in the hope that we might find a telltale sign of life, or on the Perseverance rover on Mars. And I think that kind of amount of expenditure, time, energy, money, wouldn't make sense unless optimism were true. The reason I say that is that in the first instance, it doesn't make sense to spend a lot of money on something, looking for something, unless you've got some degree of confidence, a reasonable degree you're going to find it. And secondly, I think that this point about the non-negligible number of sites is evidenced to some extent by this process as well. You know, suppose you thought that life existed out there in the galaxy, maybe in one or two places beyond Earth. There are trillions of planets. Right? It would be an instance of looking for a needle in a haystack to spend a lot of time and energy and money looking for this kind of thing if you thought it only existed in a couple of places. It only really makes sense if you think there's enough of it out there that you might have a chance of finding it. And for that to be the case, given the search, the sample size you've got to be searching, it's got to exist in quite a lot of places. So, lots of different sources of evidence converging on this claim that I'm going to call optimism, that I take to be relatively widespread in the community. Why? Why are people optimists? Where's that coming from? There is one basic source that I can find of argument or reason for optimism. You find it again and again and again in the literature. I'm going to give you some quotes shortly. And I'm going to call it the big numbers argument. That label isn't mine, by the way. I'll tell you who it is shortly. But it goes roughly like this. The thought is, very roughly to start with, that we can be reasonably confident that life exists beyond our Earth, beyond the Earth, in our galaxy, in non-negligible quantities. That is, we can be optimistic, in my sense. Because there are just so many sites out there. So many planets, so many moons, trillions. Here's a deep field shot. This is something that we've found a lot of evidence for in recent years. So as I say, you find this kind of argument being used in support of optimism all the time. And you don't really find any other arguments being used in support of optimism, but there are variants on this one. So just to give you a sense, here are Britain's two most famous astronauts, Helen Sharman and Tim Peake. And here's the party line, which they recently have cited. Start with Sharman. Aliens exist, she says. There are no two ways about it. There are so many billions of stars out there in the universe. There must be all sorts of different forms of life. And Tim Peake, slightly more detailed, this one. I think the universe is teeming with life. If you're in any doubt as to the vastness and the scale of the universe, just go and Google some of the James Webb Space Telescope shots we're getting now. The James Webb is the new era space telescope. It's replaced Hubble. And the last shot on the slide was from James Webb. I mean, hundreds of billions of stars in our own Milky Way galaxy, which is very average. So, there's a lot of different stuff going on in these quotations, but I could give you hundreds of quotations that are like this. And what we're getting at all of them is optimism, or something rather like it, backed up by the big numbers argument. Right. So, this is very common. Those quotes from Sharman and Peake are quite recent, last 5 years or so. And the big numbers argument has become prominent, mainstream in that time. But it's been around in some form or other for an awful lot longer. An awful lot longer. And it was actually kind of came to prominence in its contemporary form, probably, say, in the mid-20th century, associated in particular with Carl Sagan and Frank Drake, people who were interested in extraterrestrial intelligence. And it was picked up by a philosopher called Roy Marsh. He wrote an article about it called Big Numbers and Induction in the Case for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which was published in Philosophy of Science in 1993. And this is one of the few recent analytical engagements with the kind of argumentative foundations of the search for extraterrestrial life that you find. And it's a really fascinating paper, worth a read. What Marsh does here is he identifies optimism, roughly speaking, as a fairly widely held position. Terminology differs, details differ a bit, but. And he identifies the big numbers argument as the primary source of support for it. And he has a shot at it. And he says, look, this argumentative structure doesn't look like it works. There are various problems with it. And he tries to spell those out. So I'm going to give you a sense now of exactly what he does, exactly what his argumentative structure is. This is, in my terms, not his. Okay, so you'll see a lot of slides like this structurally today. So we're trying to get to optimism, widespread confidence in non-negligible quantities of life out there. We're trying to get there. And we've got a premise. Hope people can see that down at the back. If you can't, because there'll be a lot of stuff like this, come forward and make sure you can read the text. We're trying to get from this premise. It's our major premise. There's an enormous number of planets in the galaxy. Right. And somehow we've got to do it. The green arrow, as with all the green arrows in this talk, will signify something like argumentative support. Right. So we've got to somehow get, if optimism is to be right, from big number to big optimism. How do we do it? Well, look, clearly you're going to need at least one premise in the middle. Find it. This doesn't entail that. Right? You need something more in there. So what might it be? Well, Marsh says, if you look at the way that people argue for optimism from a big number in the big numbers argument, one of the claims you often find in there to provide that support is this. the principle of mediocrity. So the thought is that these two together, I'm going to give you that. That's the argument. So the principle of mediocrity I've summarised here as we should assume the Earth to be a fairly typical planet. The idea roughly is this. We should assume the Earth to be fairly typical. There's life on Earth. There are a lot of planets out there. So we should assume life to be fairly typical. Multiply it up by the number of planets out there and you get a reasonable chance of finding quite a lot of life out there. And if you wonder about this claim, that we should assume the Earth to be fairly typical, more sophisticated attempts to defend it appeal to a little sub-argument that supports that principle, which I'm going to call likely draw here. Right, so imagine that you've got a bag full of marbles. There are 10 marbles in the bag, and 8 of them are red, 2 are non-red. And you know that. Now you pull a marble at random without looking from the bag. You should expect to pull a red marble, or at least you should think it's likelier that you'll pull a red marble than a non-red marble. Why is that? Well, because it's likelier that you make a draw, that your draw will be from the more numerous rather than any less numerous subset. In this case, our two subsets are red and not red. Maybe it's exhausted. So it's likelier you'll pull a red one, pull a red than a not red. So that should sound innocuous. Now think about this. You've got a bag, marbles, 10 of them. You know that. But you don't know the colour of the marbles in the bag. You don't know the composition of the colours. Right? Now you pull one out, and it's red. Well, what should that make you think? Well, you should think, via likely draw this. You should think, it's likely that I've pulled a marble from the more numerous subset rather than the less numerous subset. I pulled a red, therefore it's likely that red is the more numerous subset than the less numerous subset. Therefore, it's likely that the bag has more red marbles than non-red marbles. Now think about the Earth. The Earth is like a planet that we pull from the bag of planets that we call the universe. It's got life on it. It's likely that it comes from the more numerous subset via likely draw, which seems innocuous. So there's likely a lot of life out there. Right, okay. Nice. yes. Well, so the thing is, and Marsh makes this point, albeit in slightly different terms. If that's the way you're thinking, you've got a problem. Because your argument overgeneralizes really, really badly. Because it's not just life that exists on Earth. There's loads of stuff that exists on Earth. Spaghetti bolognese, shoelaces, mobile phones. Loads of stuff. But if we've pulled the Earth from the bag of planets and life's on it, and so we've conferred that life is the more numerous subset, and then we should also do the same with any other property that we find on the Earth, right? Given that the Earth has got shoelaces on it, we should assume that the more numerous subset is shoelaces rather than not shoelaces. So we should think the galaxy is full of planets with shoelaces on them, or spaghetti bolognese, or whatever it might be. If you argue in this perfectly general kind of way, you're going to get overgeneralization. Something has gone wrong here, right? If it supports optimism about life, it supports optimism about any type of thing, not any particular token thing, but any type of thing that exists on the Earth. And that's not right. So what we would need then, if we get from big number to optimism, is a different type of argument. And it's pretty obvious what type of argument we'd need. We'd need something more specific. We need some way of restricting this really general principle. Here's the kind of thing we need. Call this mediocrity specified. We should assume the Earth to be fairly typical in hosting life, but not necessarily in other respects. Right? Fairly typical hosting life, but not in hosting all the stuff that we don't want to say is widespread in the galaxy, like shoelaces, spaghetti bolognese, whatever it might be. Put those together, You get optimism without overgeneralization. Fantastic. That's what you want. Problem. The phrase I'm going to use here is epistemic overreach. And along with overgeneralization, I'll use this phrase on multiple occasions. Marsh's point was, we're just not in a position, epistemically speaking, to confidently make that claim. What would the epistemic basis for that claim be? 1993, he writes the article, he's looking around to try and find it, can't see it. So the thought is, you've got these two routes to optimism from big number. One of them overgeneralizes. The other one, which is the kind of thing you'd need to have, is probably going to rely on a lot of empirical information that Marsh thinks we don't have. That's roughly speaking what he's doing. But here's the thing. 1993, in terms of astronomy and the search for life, was a long, long time ago. The Hubble Space Telescope had just gone up. The first exoplanet, that is the first planet outside of our solar system, was detected in 1992, which is the year that Marsh submitted his article before getting revisions. I've been in touch with him, I just had to have another rattle at it. Astrobiology, the study of life beyond Earth, subject without a content, in a sense, it didn't exist in its present form in 1993. These journals, astrobiology, the journal that publishes this stuff, didn't exist at that time. Neither did the International Astrobiological Journal. Other good journals are available. This field began about 20 years ago. A field that now, by the way, dwarfs philosophy in terms of size, money, everything. Right? So given that, you might wonder, what should we make of Marsh's skeptical case on that? So I thought I'd try and find out. Does the skeptical case hold? Or given what we know today, is optimism warranted? There's an interesting thing to ask. So let's have a look and see. That's the task for today. And I'm not going to tell you, if you haven't read the paper or read the paper, what my conclusion is. You're going to have to listen through to the bitter end and find out for yourself. Okay. Right, so what I'm going to do is, the premise that I started with when I presented Marsh's article was big numbers, a lot of planets out there. One way of adding in the new information that we've got, of which is a huge amount since 1993, is by modifying big number, by updating it, by adding in all the new stuff we've got. And that's what I'm going to start with. And you'll see what I mean in a second. So we're trying to get the structure again. We're trying to get the optimism. That's our conclusion we're going for. And now, in the year 2024, unlike in 1993, we have a new, better, improved, souped-up premise to start from, which I'm going to call big number one, and we're going to have lots of big numbers. There's an enormous number of sites with significant quantities of liquid water. That is something that people just didn't know in 1993. And we do now. I mean, there are enough in our solar system. One of the moons of Saturn was on the initial slide. The huge liquid water ocean there. Lots of other sites in the solar system like that. We have reason to believe there are millions, billions in the galaxy. And this is really important because water is an important thing for life. And indeed, when you see people present the big numbers argument today, even casually, this is one of the pieces of information they'll work in there. There's a lot of sites out there and a lot of water. So, what we need to do now is get the argument going that would get us from that premise to that conclusion. And again, you need some premises in there. This doesn't entail that. What would you need to add in to make it work, and can we do it? Well, here's one thing you might say. Here's one way you might do it. You might conjoin big number one with this premise, which I'm going to call A, which is this. If X is an important prerequisite for Y, and X exists at some site, Then there's a non-negligible likelihood that Y does as well. Put those together and you get optimism. Right? Because if there's a lot of water, water is an important prerequisite for life. Water is X, life is Y. Fiddle around with it a little bit and you get optimism. So that would do it, but the problem that we had with the initial mediocrity premise is still applicable here. The problem of overgeneralization. Because water is an important prerequisite for all kinds of things. For spaghetti bolognese, for swimming pools, for pool parties. Are we optimistic that they exist in large numbers in the galaxy beyond Earth? Presumably we're not. And insofar as we're not, that means that this way of running the argument via this premise overgeneralizes. So you all know what that means we have to do now. We have to look for a more specific premise. Not like this. It's not going to overgeneralize in this way. We might say this. Instead, B, if water exists at a site, then there's a non-negligible likelihood that life does too. That's more specific, right? That doesn't generalize to spaghetti bolognese and swimming pools and so on. I mean, you could have a separate premise, right? C, that says if water exists at a site, there's a non-negligible likelihood that swimming pools do as well. But no one wants that premise, right? This is the premise we want. So maybe we could stick those together, avoid overgeneralization, and we get the optimism. That would be nice. Issue is, why would you think that true? Why would you think B true? Now, I can think of a number of different reasons in principle that you might. One is via sampling, I'm going to say. So suppose that we took a sample, a big sample, of all of the sites beyond Earth, a large number of them, a representative sample, at which water was present, put them in front of us, so to speak, and counted through all of them and saw how many life was present in that frequency sample. Right? Then we would come up with some, if the sample size was large enough and proportional enough, we'd come up with some fraction of sites at which water is present, the life is present, and if that fraction is high enough, then B is going to be true. There's some evidence that B is true, and so we can be optimists. So that's one way you could do it. That's not an option. And the reason this time is not overgeneralization, it's epistemic overreach. We don't know of any sites beyond Earth, whether water is present there or not, at which life is present. So you can't do the sampling route. And I'm not saying like life isn't present in any of these sites. That's not the point. The point is we don't know of any where it is. And we can't be confident of any independently of assuming optimism. So that's not a route that's viable. But there's another route that you could use to try and support B. And it's what I'm going to call biopredictive modelling. So here's the idea. Even if we can't sample, perhaps we can come up with some model where, in the scientific sense, where we have a variable as an input, which is presence of water, and then the model gives us an output, which is a probability of the presence of life. And provided the output, the probability is high enough, then we could say that B is true, our model tells us that it's true, and so we could be optimists. But this is overreach as well, but for a different kind of reason. There's no such model, right? There's no model in the origins of life literature that takes you from the presence of water to as the variable to the probability for life as the output. Nor would any serious origins of life scientist expect that to be the kind of thing you could find. Knowing there's water massively underdetermines what you need to know in order to be able to do something like generating a probability for life. There's so much else you need to know as well. Are all the constituent elements of life present, for example? Here's a comparison. Imagine someone trying to generate, say they've generated a model that has as an output a probability that spaghetti bolognese is present from the following variable is the only input, whether water is present. That's not something you're going to get The former massively underdetermines the latter in terms of the information you need. So I think big number one doesn't really work as a way to support optimism. Let's try another one. We're going to build them up. Big number two. And hopefully you'll see how we got onto this one from the previous one. So we're trying to get to optimism. And this time we've got a different premise to start with, which includes more information that we've gleaned since 1993. There's an enormous number of sites with significant quantities of liquid water and life's basic constituent elements, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfur, and nitrogen. I think the evidence from astronomy gives us good reason to think that's true. Seems that way. You might think that this is a more promising, well, it's clearly a more promising way to get to optimism. We just have to fill the premises in, right? So what extra premise would you need in order to get to optimism? Well, here's one option. You could say if W, X, and Y are the basic constituents of Z, and W, X, and Y exist at some site, then there's a non-negligible likelihood that Z does too. That might do it. Put those together, and it takes you to optimism, because we've got the basic elements hanging around along with water. Same problem, right? This overgeneralizes really badly. The basic constituents of spaghetti bolognese are also carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, whatever. I don't know what the basic constituents are. But we don't want to be optimistic about that existing in large quantities throughout the galaxy. Again, you're going to get optimism about far too much stuff if you go in that route. So that's not a viable option. We need something more specific. We could try this. If water and basic constituent elements exist at the site, then there's a non-negligible likelihood that life does too. That's more specific. It's going to avoid overgeneralization. Put the two premises together, you're going to get optimism. So that looks good. Much better than C. Again, the issue though is, why do you think that's true? Why do you think D is true? And again, there are two different types of answer that I think you can appeal to. One is via sampling. You can imagine we take the set this time of all of the sites at which water and the basic constituent elements are present, set them up in front of us, and just go through each one by one, counting through, and seeing how many life is present at. We get a fraction. If the fraction is big enough, we get D. If D is correct, then optimism is correct as well. And the issue is exactly what it was for sampling when it came to big number one, which is, this is epistemic overreach. We don't know of any sites beyond Earth at which life is present. Doesn't matter if you've added in carbon and hydrogen or whatever else. So that can't be it. What about via predictive modelling? That's the other option. Could you have a model that has as input just these variables? Presence of water, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus. Output, probability of life. Output's non-negligible. Supports C, supports optimism. Sounds better. Is better. But I think it would be a very bad basis from which to try to defend optimism. There's nothing like this in the origins of life literature. There are various different ideas about how life might have emerged, various different attempts to model. But the basic problem is the same as was the case with water. Just knowing that these constituent elements in water are present massively underdetermines what you need to know in order to be able to do something like provide a model that generates a probability that's non-negligible for life. You need to know all kinds of other things on any attempt to provide an origin of life story. Lots of other variables. Temperature, the period of time the elements are together, the amount of them, salinity, acidity, pressure, exposure to radiation. There are a huge number of extra variables that any serious attempt to think about how life emerges from non-life would need to include and do include in the attempts to do so in the literature. So in much the same way, for much the same reason, the big number one fails, big number two does as well. Maybe epistemic overreach. Now, I think this leads us on to, the failure of these two leads us on to what looks like the most promising option, an option that allows us to get around the problem we've just encountered a number of occasions here. So, we've got optimism over here, we're trying to get there. Here's a premise, a version of big number, which is called big number three, that looks like it might be suited to resolving the problems we've just seen with trying to get it from big numbers one and two, and which you might think is plausible given what we now know about the galaxy. There's an enormous number of sites with conditions a bit like those on Earth. Maybe that's something that we now know that MASH didn't know at the time. So conditions like those on Earth, that's a broad enough expression that it allows that we can talk about whatever, that can include whatever the relevant variables are that we're missing in big number one and big number two, in addition to water, in addition to the basic elements. And you do find people making versions of the big number argument that use expressions like this. So the issue is how you would get there again. And again, you're going to need an interim premise. And on this occasion, the interim premise is pretty obvious. It would be this. There's a non-negligible likelihood that life emerges in the kind of conditions found on Earth. And you might think that's a good bet. And it would take us there. And you might think it's a good bet because we're here. Right, life did emerge in the conditions found on Earth. Perhaps we could make that support me. So this looks like the most promising option available. So we're going to have a look at it. But before we even look at it, actually as it stands, it's ambiguous. And we got it disambiguate. So there's one way of hearing this, big number three and E both together, which is a de dicto reading, and one way of hearing it, which is a de re reading. We're going to divide them up and decide which we're going to work with. So in the de re reading, big number three really says, there's an enormous number of sites with specific conditions, X, Y, Z, wherever they are, like those on Earth. And there's a non-negligible likelihood that life emerges from conditions X, Y, Z. That's on the de re reading. On the de dicto reading, big number three says, there's an enormous number of sites with conditions like those on Earth, whatever they are. Don't know. And there's a non-negligible likelihood that life emerges in the kind of conditions, in these kind of conditions, the kinds of conditions found on Earth, wherever they are. Now, if you want to be an optimist, you've got to go for the de dicto reading. And the reason you've got to go for the de dicto reading is that it would be epistemic overreach to try to make the de re reading work. And the reason it would be epistemic overreach to make the de re reading work is that we don't know, aside from extremely broad brush terms, what the specific conditions X, Y, Z from which life emerged on Earth were. That's a common assumption of claim in the origins of life literature. And a lot of people think we'll never know. That's better than wastes of time. Given that, you would be extremely bold indeed to try to argue from this to optimism. You're much better to say, admittedly we don't know. We don't know what these conditions are, but we can still say that there's an enormous number of sites with conditions like those, or whatever they are, without having to pin our colours to the mast of some specific theory of abiogenesis on Earth, and say that there's a non-negligible likelihood that life emerged from those, whatever they are. And that's still supported by the fact that we're having them over. So let's see what happens then if we run with this de dicto reading. So we're trying to get to optimism. We've got the de dicto reading of big number three. We're trying to get there. We need an interim premise. What's it going to be? Well, we know what it is as well because it's the de dicto reading of E. And that's the support we need for optimism. Best argument so far, what should we make of it? Well, there's an issue. There are a number of issues that should be flagged at this point. One issue is what I'm going to call the specificity of the conditions of life's emergence on Earth. And the red arrow here indicates this is going to be a problem. So, the fact that life did in fact emerge on Earth doesn't entail that there's a non-negligible likelihood that it emerged on Earth. There might be a lot of happening. So we should be wary, and we should think, are there any reasons to think, what's the balance of probabilities here? Do we have reasons to think that it was a lucky happening? Do we have reasons that it wasn't? And one issue is that all of the origin of life research is very clear on the fact that the conditions that are needed for life to emerge seem to be extremely specific. It's what we call the fine-tuning problem, right? Just at the level of a life rather than the universe. To the extent that we have, as of yet, no account of how life actually emerged, in which people can be terribly confident from the prior conditions, and we haven't been able to simulate it in the laboratory. And this leads some people to think, this is a non, it's a, I don't know if it's a standard view, it's one of the views kicking around, that it may indeed have been somewhat unlikely happening that life emerged on Earth. And there's another issue. All of the life that's present on Earth seems to come from a single social origin. And so we have no reason to think that life emerged more than once in the history of Earth. Given that we've no reason to think it emerged more than once in Earth's history, that provides some kind of prima facie problem for the idea that it emerges with a non-negligible likelihood from the conditions on Earth. Because you might think, if E was true, it would have emerged more than once. But we have no reason to think it did. So there are some problems with E. Problems to the extent that I think you wouldn't want to rely on it as a premise for optimism. You couldn't be very, put it like this, you couldn't be very confident in it. But some people think it's true nonetheless, and they appeal to, in order to support it, the fact that life seemed to emerge very early on in Earth's history. So Earth's about 4.5 billion years old. Life seems to first emerge about 3.9 billion years ago, not long into Earth's history. And some people think that that suggests that there's a non-negligible likelihood of its emergence via a principle that we can call early draw, which is this. Roughly speaking, the earlier a draw, the likelier it was. So here's the idea. Suppose you're playing a lottery and you don't know how many people are in the lottery. You just know that every week a ticket is drawn. One ticket, and that's the winning ticket. And suppose you win the lottery in week one. This should alter your distribution in terms of the question of how big that lottery was. It should just skew you toward a prediction that the lottery is smaller rather than larger. And you can quantify exactly how much the probability distribution should be skewed in virtue of this. The general thought is that, as it says here, the earlier something happens in a repeated pattern, the likelier it was to happen in any given instance. So the fact that life emerged early in Earth's history suggests that its emergence was non-negligibly likely. That's the rough idea. But I think there's a big problem with this, and so with this. And the problem here is overgeneralization again. So if you think that life's emergence was non-negligibly likely because it was very early in Earth's history, then you should think that anything that happened early in the Earth's history at the same kind of time was also non-negligibly likely. But presumably we could imagine all kinds of things that happened at the same time as the emergence of Earth that we don't think were non-negligibly likely. So just think about some event and specify it very precisely that occurred on Earth's history at the same time as the emergence of life. Perhaps a rock that was 2 meters wide and weighed 15 kilos fell a height of 3 meters and landed on the bottom of the ocean bed and rode a little bit and landed on something or other. Tell some story about something you think is highly unlikely to have happened all across the galaxy, or at least you think isn't likely to have happened in lots of places. There are going to be some such things. But if you're working just from early to up, and this might be easy, then you should think that these things were likely too. And that seems like an overgeneralization worry. So I think the sense of E is problematic. Basically, there's some reasons to doubt it, and the support that people provide for it is, I think, a bit shaky. And in any case, the specificity of the conditions of life's emergence on Earth makes trouble for big number three. So big number three says there's an enormous number of sites with conditions like those on Earth, whatever they are. But if it's right that the conditions under which life emerged are extremely specific, and it wouldn't have emerged with only minor variations in the relevant variables, then it's not obvious that we can claim that big number three is true. The more specific the conditions are, the less likely it is that big number three is true. So when you put all this together, I find it hard to see how you could be confident that there's a large amount of life out there. It seems just much too strong a conclusion to want to draw. So I don't want to say that. That's episode of overreach. So this kind of pushes us toward the following view, the failure of big number one, two, and three. That optimism would have to be supported by something like big number four. There's an enormous number of sites with conditions of a near arbitrary degree of similarity to those on Earth. Like, if you could say that, right, then you'd be fine, because presumably this is true. There's a non-negligible likelihood, you've a better shot at this being true. There's a non-negligible likelihood that life emerges with conditions arbitrarily similar to those which have emerged on Earth. But the issue is this premise, big number four. First of all, it seems like an instance of epistemic overreach. And we know there are a lot of planets out there, we know some things about them. But I don't think we know anything that's as strong as that there are a large number with an almost arbitrary degree of similarity to those on Earth. And secondly, suppose we did know that, and that were our basis for thinking that life is likely to emerge there. Well, why shouldn't we also then think that bobbleheads and shoelaces are likely to emerge there as well? So, the failure of being number one, two, and to a lesser extent three, I think push you toward thinking something like you need big number four, you need something like that, but that's just not feasible. Both because it overreaches and because it overgeneralizes. So where does that leave us? Well, there's another option, which is kind of a slightly different one, an outlier, called big number five, which I'm actually not going to go through here because it is a bit of an outlier. It's just adding some more information in. So I'm going to skip through to the last slide. We can talk about that one if you want. So look, Mash's thought was that optimism requires either overgeneralization or epistemic overreach. Overgeneralization when it comes to the principle of mediocrity, epistemic overreach when it comes to a restricted version of that. My thought was, is that still the case after 40 years if we plug in what we now know? And I mean, I don't know, but it kind of looks to me like it is. Maybe we're in a slightly better position, but the same basic problem seems to arise no matter what new information you add in. And I don't think in all of this that I've said anything that is too contentious. So optimism looks to me then insufficiently supported, which is really curious because, first of all, temperamentally, I want to say that I'm an optimist. Not about life, not anyone who knows that's not the case, but about this stuff. It seems right, the view seems right to me. But I can't see why? And secondly, it's a bit of a mystery because there are lots of people who work on the origins of life, who work on astronomy, who work on these kind of things, who seem to make claims that are really rather like optimism based on arguments that are really rather like the big numbers argument. And I assume these people, they must know something that I don't. I don't know what it is that I'm missing. I assume that there's something to the view, but I'm looking and I can't find it. So here's some possible places where I've gone wrong. And I say this genuinely, like, rather than here's some places I've gone wrong and I'm going to close them down. I don't mean that. I mean genuinely places I could have gone wrong. One is that optimism isn't widespread, and so I'm attacking something with a straw man. That's not true. You find it everywhere, unless you were overstating the case. You know, maybe Sharman and Peake overstate the case for finding extraterrestrial life because they want NASA to get more funding or whatever. I don't think that's the case. I think it is widespread. Another possibility is that, yeah, it's widespread, but it's justified by a different argument, something other than the big numbers argument. That's possible, but I can't find the other argument. And furthermore, I find this argument all the time. So, I'm not sure about that. Third option is I made a factual mistake. Like, I misunderstood something with respect to what we know about the constituents of the universe, what we know about the origins of life. I've run this stuff past the people who, I mean, it's not like I pulled this out of nowhere. I think I've got a sense of what's going on in these literatures. I've run this stuff past people who do, and I'm not getting back an obvious candidate for what the mistake might be, but I'm all ears if you know what it is. Fourthly, I've made a philosophical mistake. That's an option. I mean, that's almost certain, right? I'm pretty sure of that, but in a kind of preface paradox style way, I just know it's not an individual slide. So those are my options. And if none of those is right, then maybe optimism is under-supported. Last slide. So I'm working at the minute on this project on kind of philosophical foundations of the search for extraterrestrial life, which is lots of different dimensions, lots of different components. This is one part of it. I've got a lot of other work on it, which is here, roughly speaking. And take a look, and then you know what you think, or if you want to look at any manuscripts, I'd be really interested for feedback. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.